Hi, this is the Reason Podcast, and I'm Nick Gillespie. Please subscribe to us at iTunes and rate and review us while you're there. Today, we are talking with Reason senior editor and author of many books, including Saying Yes, In Defense of Drug Use, Jacob Sullum. And we're going to be talking about marijuana policy in the year 2008, and especially a new document that Attorney General Jeff Sessions has just put forward that seems to be trying to put the brakes on marijuana legalization, among other things. Jacob, thanks for talking.
Sure. Thanks for having me.
So let's get right to it. What did Sessions actually declare today?
Well, he issued this one-page memo to U.S. attorneys where he rescinded a series of other memos dealing with marijuana enforcement. In a nutshell, those memos said in deciding whether to prosecute state legal marijuana businesses, federal prosecutors should be guided by federal law enforcement priorities, which, you know, is not terribly controversial. And in fact, Sessions agreed with. But it was one thing what they actually said, and the way they were interpreted is another thing, which is in practice, at least since 2013, U.S. attorneys have not been targeting state licensed marijuana businesses as long as they comply with state law.
Right.
That's been the practice. And this memo officially does not change the policy because, again, the policy didn't say we wouldn't prosecute them. The policy said we're going to be guided by certain priorities. Here's a bunch of them. They've actually listed the former Deputy Attorney General James Cole listed 8 specific things. But then he added there could be others, you know. And so on paper, officially, U.S. attorneys are always free to go after state licensed marijuana businesses. In practice, they haven't done so. It's not clear whether they're going to start doing that now. And it all depends on how they react to Sessions' memo.
Yeah. So what's the tea leaves? I hate to say reading tea leaves here. It sounds like we're using code words that went out of style with the Beatles. But, you know, read the marijuana tea leaves here. Is this, you know, it had been long feared by people that whereas Donald Trump didn't really seem to give a, you know, give too much. He just didn't care that much about marijuana. He's against drug use. He's a teetotaler and all of that, but he didn't seem to be bent out of shape by it. But Jeff Sessions has a long history as a drug warrior and said many disquieting things when he became attorney general. Do you think this means that there's going to be a new war on pot?
I am skeptical that that's going to happen. First of all, we should note it's not just that Trump doesn't care that much about the issue. He specifically has said it should be left up to the states. Definitely in the case of medical, he actually supports medical marijuana. He has said he doesn't think it's a good idea to legalize it for recreational use, but it still should be left up to the states. Most Republicans agree with that, by the way. Even when most Republicans were not supporting legalization, they were saying it should be left to the states. So this is not politically a great issue to take on. It's contradicting his boss. It's going to alienate a lot of Republicans who believe in federalism, Republicans who represent states that have legalized marijuana, like Cory Gardner, the senator from Colorado, who's really pissed off on Twitter today. So it's politically does not seem like a winner. Sessions is already in a precarious position vis-a-vis Trump because of the Russia investigation.
Is this his way to get out? I mean, is this like he's trying to it's like George Costanza. He's trying to figure out how he can get fired or something.
I don't know. I'm not sure this would be a fireable offense, but it's not going to endear him to his boss any more than he already is. And it's all, you know, all hinges on how U.S. attorneys respond to it. He's still not doing all he could. I mean, if he were serious about disrupting the legal marijuana market, he could be doing a lot more. He could be explicitly calling for a crackdown. He's not doing that. He's saying, is it going to leave it to your discretion? Do you decide what's important in terms of federal priorities, how you want to allocate your resources, which marijuana cases you want to take on? It's up to you. That's what he's saying. And so he's not saying they should do it. And he also, by the way, has not, this is kind of conspicuous that he hasn't tried to challenge the state marijuana laws in court. The Obama administration never did that. They could have. He can go to court and argue that any time you set up a regime where you are officially authorizing the production and distribution of marijuana, you're violating the Controlled Substances Act. He has not tried to do that. And they know he's had, you know, nearly a year now, and he hasn't gone to court. So that suggests to me that he's not really serious about this.
So then we're just left with, I mean, he's just trolling people. And is it because, you know, is he trying to direct attention from something else? I don't know. But Do you, of the states that neither have medical marijuana nor recreational marijuana, are there any state-level attorney, or rather federal prosecutors in those states who are particularly known for really pushing on pot or anything like that? Is there any reason to believe that this might be, you know, the go-ahead for a particular prosecutor in, you know, X, Y, or Z state?
I don't know. You know, this, like I said, it all hinges on whether a particular U.S. attorney decides this is a good use of his resources. Mm-hmm. And that's, you know, I think that, you know, for Sessions, this is, he's a true believer. He really does not like marijuana. He really does not like marijuana legalization. He may be smart enough to realize he can't actually stop it. You know, he can screw things up over the short term. He can cause serious disruption for the marijuana industry. I mean, even just, you know, a U.S. attorney, if he wanted to, could just send letters to every, like, you know, there's a list of them, all the licensed, you know, retailers and growers and manufacturers in the state. Send them all letters saying you're going to warn you, you're subject to being raided and prosecuted and your property could be forfeited. Send letters to the landlords who rent these people. There's lots of things they could do that wouldn't take a lot of resources, a lot of time, but really would cause a lot of disruption. Haven't done it for, you know, nearly a year now that he's been in office. It's not clear that they're going to want to start doing that, because then what happens if, even if you're successful in getting rid of those businesses and getting them to close down, almost all of the states that have legalized marijuana allow home cultivation. So now production is going to shift to thousands and thousands of home growers. That's much harder to control and monitor. So that's not, even for Jeff Sessions, that's not a good result. So it's not clear that even if he felt unconstrained by his boss's expectations or by politics, that he would really want to shut down the licensing and regulation system, because that doesn't make, you know, it doesn't end up with a result that people who are against pot would necessarily like.
Well, so he's a an enigma wrapped in a riddle in the middle of a THC gummy bear or something. We just have really no reason. We at this point, you have no sense of why he is doing what he's doing, other than
maybe he's high. He doesn't like marijuana. He wants to make a statement that there's still a federal ban on this. There are no guarantees. You know, there have never been any guarantees, but he's making it abundantly clear that there are no guarantees. Nobody should consider, you know, himself safe just because he has a state license. Just because he hasn't been raided yet doesn't mean he's safe in the future. I think he gets emotional satisfaction from making that statement, but I'm not sure what the practical results are going to be, except that obviously the uncertainty is bad for investment. It's bad for expanding businesses or finding banking services for businesses. All of these things are jeopardized by the legal uncertainty, which this contributes to, but didn't create. I mean, the legal uncertainty will continue as long as it's federally illegal.
He is. He once said that only bad people. Was it that good people don't do pot, or that only bad people do pot? Didn't he do some variation?
Yeah, good
on
people
that?
Don't smoke marijuana, but he actually walked that back recently. He was asked about that at a congressional hearing, and he said, no, what he didn't mean literally that good people don't, but that's what you should tell the kids, that in order to send a message that they shouldn't use drugs, you should lie to them and tell them that good people don't use
marijuana. Because, lying to kids about drug use, I mean, I know that's, that it's ridiculous. But let's talk, you know, 2018, though, in many ways, regardless of Jeff Sessions, and maybe this is what, you know, got under his skin, is that 2018 is, you know, quite potentially the year that pot legalization, that recreational pot, really does go mainstream. Obviously, this is a movement that has been building for decades. But with California, starting the beginning of the legal recreational marijuana, Nevada is coming online. You know, they already are joining other states that have been up and running for a number of years. Massachusetts is supposed to start allowing the legal sale and distribution of pot in the middle of the year at some point. How do you feel about that? Like, how big a deal is it that California, that California, the largest, most populous state in the country, is actually saying, okay, you know, recreational pot is legal?
Well, I mean, in a sense, it's long overdue, because they were the first state to legalize medical marijuana. That was way back in 1996, and it's taken them this long to finally legalize it generally. It's a huge market. You know, it'll be the biggest legal pot market, you know, eventually. There's still a lot of black market activity going on there. And Nevada is going to be another huge market because of all the visitors to Las Vegas. So, you know, that's a big deal. If you look at the polling on this, the last Gallup poll actually found a majority of Republicans, not just a majority of Americans. I think overall it's like 64% of Americans support legalization, but at least 51% or so of Republicans support it. And like I said, even among the people who don't support it, a large majority say that states should be allowed to do this. So I don't think there's any putting the genie back in the bottle or the toothpaste back in the tube or whatever stupid metaphor you prefer.
Whatever dumb thing you would try to do if, in fact, you were totally high. Yeah.
It can't be stopped. It can be slowed down. And, you know, the question is, you know, is it worth doing that and causing all that disruption for the sake of emotional satisfaction, which is really what it's about for somebody like Sessions, who viscerally just hates marijuana. And doesn't like to see it legitimized. Too bad. You know, it's going to be legitimized. He's going to have to get used to the idea. It's a question of how long it will take.
How, you know, where do you see the kind of pot culture going? Because, you know, it's kind of fascinating to think about. We're roughly the same age. I mean, we're born in, if I'm making you older than you are, then correct me. But, you know, in the mid 60s, and we grew up with Cheech and Chong, and we grew up with pretty ubiquitous pot. But also stoner culture was a very specific subgenre, and it was, you know, I wouldn't say that it was fully demonized, but it was, you know, it was kind of a cartoon. In the intervening years, certainly in the 90s and 2000s, pot culture has really gone legitimate in a lot of different ways. Where do you see kind of marijuana culture trending? You remember or better than I do, like the whole idea of where there were people who would say, well, you know, it's one thing for drinks to be legal or for alcohol to be legal because we have this long history of kind of mediating institutions that will, you know, make sure that people don't overdose or overdo it or this or that, and we have protocols. But we don't have that with pot culture. And of course, we didn't have that with pot culture because it was illegal and you could go to jail. But those cultures have all grown up. I mean, where do you see pot culture going?
Well, it's, you know, I think you're seeing a culture of responsible use developing. It already had developed even when it was completely illegal, but it's much easier to talk about things like, you know, how much of this pot cookie should I eat? How long should I wait before, you know, I expect it to take full effect? You know, how intoxicated will I be? There's an app I just downloaded that is supposed to tell you how stoned you are. It has you do a bunch of tasks that involve divided attention and hand-eye coordination, various kinds of skills that you need for driving. And you do establish a baseline. And then after you smoke pot, you test yourself to see how stoned I am. And you know, that's a great tool. I mean, I can't endorse it because I'm not 100% sure this particular product actually works, but it's a great idea. And it shows you, you know, that shows you, this is the responsible marijuana user who doesn't, wants to know exactly how impaired he is. And of course, police are having to talk about this as well and starting to admit that, you know, you really can't rely on THC levels in the blood. It's not a good indicator of impairment. If we're serious about this being a legal product, but we still want to discourage people from using it in a dangerous way, how do we go about doing that? So these are conversations we're starting to have. Meanwhile, you're starting to see, it's interesting. If you look back, like in the late 70s, it was the time that marijuana use among teenagers actually peaked. Even though support, you know, general support for legalization, which was much lower then, and it became even lower during the Reagan administration. That right now, with it being legitimized and legalized throughout the country, you actually don't see an increase in underage marijuana use, and in some cases you see a decline. So you know, the idea is that if you legalize it, it's not so cool anymore. And to some extent, that seems to be true. You're not seeing this broad cultural effect where, because it is legal now, suddenly teenagers are clamoring to use it.
Yeah, I mean, I was going to ask you, what is the theoretical mechanism? We can see these data points, and nobody really seems to be disputing the idea that as pot is generally pot use and pot legalization is both more of a reality and more accepted, teen use or underage use seems to be going down, or at worst, the staying level. Do you think it's just that taking away the forbidden fruit? You know, kids are like, oh, okay, I'm going to go snort opioids instead or something.
Yeah, I think there's something to that. In some ways, it's not as appealing as it used to be. You know, that's sort of the cultural impact of it, right? So that means even if I don't live in a state where it's been legalized, I hear about this. They were saying this even when marijuana is being legalized just for medical use. Oh, you're going to encourage the kids to smoke pot. And it turned out not to be true over and over again. It was not true that happened.
No, it's why, you know, there was
the cultural effect. But,
yeah, when K-O-Pectate came on the market and, you know, because it was medicine, the kids started using K-O-Pectate all the time, right? I mean,
once cancer patients and AIDS patients are using it, you know, suddenly it's cool.
Yeah.
Every teenager wants it. So it
It'll make
not to
me
true.
So skinny, you know?
There still is a question that hasn't been resolved yet, is which has to do with access, right? So you legalize this drug. So now it's harder to get, it's much harder to get marijuana from a legal business. Now that everybody's carding, you can get it, to get it directly is harder than it is to get marijuana directly from a street dealer, because they don't
care.
What is going on? You do have this issue of leakage from the adult market, right? As you do with alcohol, if an adult buys it, so now his younger brother can get it, or his kid can get it, whether either by swiping it or an older, you could readily see, a 21 or 22 year old sharing marijuana with his teenage brother, which would be illegal, but completely predictable. The question is whether
have you been listening into the arguments I've been having with my two kids?
Yeah, just so you know, it is illegal, unless they're over 21 or older. But, so that sort of thing is bound to happen. The question is whether that kind of diversion will have such an impact that you will, over the longer term, see underage use, teenage use going up. It remains to be seen whether that's true or not.
What is the latest on kind of black market sales? Because this is, also fascinating, and I've heard differing accounts out of places like Washington, say, the state of Washington, where, the tax rates, it's kind of more difficult to get pot, it's taxed higher, et cetera, and that there's more of a black market there than in a place like Colorado, which seems to have done a better job of kind of making pot available, although it still is, kind of annoying. But, are black markets disappearing, or is it too early to tell?
Well, I think they're getting smaller. The more you tax it, the more you regulate it, the harder you make it for legal businesses to compete with black market dealers. Washington is still taxing marijuana very heavily. I just looked at these numbers, and when you add up all the taxes, it's the various sales tax, local taxes, plus state tax, plus the state marijuana tax, excise tax, and they collapse it all into one. There's a 37% rate at retail plus of the sales tax, and it adds up to nearly a 50% burden. In other words, it raises the price by 50% from what it would otherwise be. And even to begin with, you're probably starting with a higher cost because of the compliance issues, which cost money, and you have a fixed location that you have to take care of, unlike your average pot dealer. So already you're starting with higher compliance costs and infrastructure costs, and you pile these taxes on top of it, you're making it even harder for the legal licensed businesses to displace the black market. If they were smart, what they would do is start with no tax. That's my ideal situation.
Okay, sure. Also free samples as well.
But the point is, you start with, even if you think in the future this is going to be a good source of revenue, which I think is an exaggerated hope. But even in the future, you're thinking we can make some money from this. Initially, have zero tax or very little tax. Let the legal market displace the black market. And then you can start to think, oh, maybe we can, not that I recommend this, but maybe we can raise taxes a little bit and bring in a little bit more money. They're doing it just the opposite way, where they're taxing the hell out and like, shit, the black market's not disappearing. Yeah. What did we do wrong? Maybe we need to raise lower taxes.
Well, let's raise taxes so we can hire more cops to police the black market, right?
I'm just saying you can expect initial problems the first few years. It's going to take a while. But if you're talking about a decade or two and you still have a thriving black market, you've done something
right. Yeah. What, you know, in California, speaking of problems, there's been a lot of discussion of how Los Angeles in particular, which for a while had the most medical marijuana dispensaries and, you know, seemed to be leading in that, they've really kind of botched the launch of legal recreational pot. What's going on there, and what's the best way to resolve the issues?
Well, I mean, the thing about California is they had, like I said, medical marijuana since 96, and it was a relatively loose regime where pretty much anybody who was willing to go to a doctor could get a note that would allow him to buy marijuana. So critics would often say it's, you basically already legalized marijuana. And to some extent, that, or a large extent, that was true. I mean, it depends how determined you are, how willing you are to fake an illness or whatever.
Right.
There wasn't that much of a barrier. But the problem is, I think that that really just kind of discredited the industry, because it was all, not all of it, but much of it was built around fakery. So you had people who were pretending to be patients, pretending to have symptoms with marijuana relieved, and they were able to get marijuana that way, when really they just, you know, nothing wrong with it. Really just wanted to get high or relax or whatever. That's fine. There's nothing wrong with that. It's just that because the way the law was, they had to pretend. So I think that sort of brought the industry into disrepute. Also, there was a lot of finagling in California, Los Angeles in particular, having to do with, you know, can we actually have a business that sells medical marijuana? That was never, it was not originally explicitly allowed. They came up with this idea of, well, we're a patient collective, and you come here, you're not a customer, you become a member of our collective, and then you can share in our bounty, and, you know, all a lot of bullshit.
But, and you can't bring a plate, you can't use a plastic bag to take your, you know, it needs to be a fabric.
Yeah. Hemp, don't be crazy.
I guess
yeah.
hemp would be the ultimate fabric, right?
Don't come in here with that. So I think so. A lot of it has to do with the fact that there was so much phoniness and fakery and fraud involved in all of this, that it sort of brought the industry into disrepute. And you have these marijuana, you know, medical marijuana, especially medical marijuana dispensaries proliferating all through the city, and it bothered people. The fact that it struck them that these weren't really, you know, sick people; that they were mostly, you know, young people just trying to have a good time. And maybe they were a little rowdy or whatever, right? So people are reacting to the unseemliness of it and the nuisance of it. There's no reason that, you know, that the industry has to be operated that way. Once you say that, no, this is what we're doing, this is for fun, you know,
right.
This is our business, it's fun. And of course you don't have to fake a symptom or go to a doctor. And, you know, obviously you can have the same regulations that apply to bars or any other business that potentially could create a nuisance. But don't have to, and you make sure that people don't impinge on others and are responsible for their behavior.
What is going to happen to people who are in jail for nonviolent pot, you know, sales or transactions? I mean, has there been a movement? Sarah Siskind, who is one of the writers of Mostly Weekly, the Reason TV sketch show, talks about ghost crimes, about like what, you know, and what happens to people who are in jail for things that have been legalized. Do you have any sense of that? Are these people being let out? And I realize, you know, there may be a vanishingly small number of people who are actually in jail specifically for nonviolent drug transactions involving pot. But, you know, what happens to those people?
I started to look into this issue a while back, and it first of all turned out there weren't that many people who fit that description.
Right. Because even in prohibition, even under prohibition, a lot of the times people would be put in jail for something like evasion of taxes or something. So it wasn't quite the crime itself.
But that's a good question. An example, with alcohol prohibition, what happened to the people who had been convicted under that law, which existed for like 13 years and they went away? For the most part, they were, you know, out of prison by then, but some of them got pardons. To this day, you still see people being pardoned for bootlegging. Now it's more, you know, not bootlegging during prohibition, but bootlegging,
yeah.
You know,
yeah,
to evade, you know, federal taxes and regulations.
Yeah.
So I do think that there is, you know, a need for that. In terms of people who are convicted of doing things that are now legal, certainly whoever's in charge of that, you know, the governor who's in charge of that state, for example, should be pardoning them if that's what they did, because even though they're out of prison, they still face all these obstacles as a result of having a felony conviction. Yeah, so I'm not sure, honestly, that anybody's done that. They should do that. It makes sense.
So two final questions. The first is anything lost in the legalization of pot? And here I don't want to be romanticizing an outlaw year or anything like that. And even thinking about it, it makes me choke up of the millions of people really whose lives have been ruined by stupid drug laws involving pot, and all of that hysteria. But is there anything that is lost, or is it all good?
Well, I'm not sure that anything is lost on balance. Obviously, I think it's on balance, it's a good thing. But you lose a really good example of a stupid, widely disobeyed government policy, which is an entry point for people. If you want to encourage them to be skeptical of government or suspicious of government, and to think seriously about what's the proper role of government, that is a very good entry point for a lot of people, right? Because this is something they're familiar with. They agree that this is totally stupid. It's a total waste of time. It's unjust. It's irrational, and so on. So you do lose that, right? Because this is a very widely flouted law. And in the same way that alcohol prohibition was, right? That the alcohol prohibition, while it lasted, was a good way of encouraging people to be skeptical of government. It's not better to have kept it.
Certainly not.
So you lose that. The other thing I worry about is that once it's legal, pretty throughout the country, and this federal state conflict is resolved, I worry that people won't extend the logic of it. In other words, that they will say, we took care of pot, therefore the war on drugs is not a problem anymore. And it's just these other drugs, the ones that I don't use and my friends don't use, that are still illegal, and they should be illegal because they're bad.
Right.
Unlike
pot.
Pot wasn't so bad, and these other. So that's my fear, is like, where do you go once you've legalized marijuana? What's the next drug that you can try to legalize where you will get broad support? And they're really there are not a lot of obvious choices.
Psychedelics are.
Not because they're so widely enjoyed. In fact, they're not, not many people like them, not many people use them, but they can, especially through the sort of medical route that marijuana took, become less threatening. If you say, look, this is very useful for people who are dying, to help them resolve these end of life issues. This is very useful for people who've been through trauma and to try to process that or whatever. Or even LSD is good for cluster headaches, that kind of thing can help legitimize them. And I think we've gotten enough distance from the sort of LSD panics and other panics about hallucinogens that people are more willing to look at it calmly. So potentially that's an area to explore, but it does not have the same kind of built-in support as marijuana legalization did, just simply because not nearly as many people use those drugs and enjoy them.
Oh, and the difference is vast. I mean, nearly a majority of Americans have tried pot, whereas when you start to look at psychedelics or even cocaine and things like that, it's just, it's pennies on the dollar compared. So it seems to be a very different thing.
That's the sad thing, because if you ask, why is alcohol legal but marijuana isn't, at least under federal law, it's not legal. Even though alcohol seems to be more dangerous in all these various ways, and it doesn't seem rational. And the only reason is that it's a question of how many people like it and how many people use it and who's using it, right? Because it's always other people's drugs that you want to ban. And marijuana has moved from being other people, a drug that other people used, Mexicans and blacks,
jazz musicians.
Hippies.
To
becoming a mainstream drug. And that's in a way good, because people have become more tolerant and open to, different kinds of rituals and habits and so on, and pastimes, whatever you want to call it. But it's also bad, because it suggests to me that we're only willing to extend our tolerance to us and people like. Whereas when it comes to people who seem strange to us and their habits and things they enjoy, we're much more willing to prohibit them out of fear. And so that worries me. I'm not sure where you can go next after you've legalized marijuana.
Right. Final question. What do you think will be the first deep red state, blood red state, conservative state, Republican dominated state, even though in some ways Republicans have been, you know, out front on this issue. But what do you think is going to be the first red state to legalize recreational marijuana?
Well, I mean, doesn't Alaska count?
You know, it doesn't. Yeah, no, because Alaska is the biggest welfare state in America. No, well, it's like, what, there are 10 people in Alaska, and half of them are either related, you know, they're related to Sarah Palin. You know, let's say, obviously Hawaii is not a red state necessarily, but let's keep it to the contiguous, the continental 48. What do you think will be the first red state to go in, and when will it happen?
Well, I'm not ready to put any money down, but I will.
We're
say
not asking you to put money down. Just, you know, just
Texas is a lot, mm-hmm. I think, more receptive than I used to think, and more receptive than is commonly believed, because there is a sort of strong libertarian tendency.
Right. Or a get off my lawn in tendency, at the very least. And I mean, if Texas and California have legalized pot, I mean, you know what? There's like virtually nothing. Yeah, everybody has that almost.
Well, no, I mean, Utah will hold out. Oklahoma will hold out. Yeah. I would say Texas will go, you know, before Utah and Oklahoma. I'm not sure Texas is going to be anytime soon. But they did, you know, they legalized certain kinds of cannabis extracts, not the kind that get you high. And to my surprise, they actually seem to be coming up with a regulated an authorized supply. And the main problem with most states that authorized these extracts is that they said it was okay to use them, but they didn't provide any way you could legally get them. In Texas, they're actually moving ahead gradually in a limited way with making that available. That sort of surprised me. So I could see, you know, other kinds of marijuana products being legal for medical use not so far down the road. And you're starting to see decriminalization of possession and that sort of thing. And so I think it's not, you know, I wouldn't rule it out in my lifetime that,
right. Okay.
that it'll be legal.
Well, so that I said that was the final question, but let me ask you this. You know, I mean, you've been working at Reason on and off, and you've been a journalist since what, like the late 80s, early 90s, right?
Late 80s, yeah.
Okay, yeah. And you've always been, you know, interested in legalizing pot. You know, I in a similar way, I have too. And like, you know, this was coming. I mean, like, you could imagine it. But how does it make you feel to actually, I mean, I feel almost like, you know, an East German dissident when the Berlin Wall is starting to come down. And, you know, there's still a huge amount of crap left to go, and that, you know, things are starting to move, but, you know, there's still a lot of trouble ahead. But, you know, how do you feel about it? It's, you know, and also your work has been, you know, instrumental in kind of countering drug hysteria, popularizing the idea, in particular in the book, Saying Yes, of responsible drug use, that people can be responsible drug users just as they are responsible drinkers. How are you feeling these days about, you know, about all that?
Well, in a sense, it's very encouraging. It happened a lot faster than I expected, but it makes me feel strange. You know, when I like woke up and I read this editorial in the New York Times saying, you know, we should legalize marijuana.
Yeah,
I thought, you know, maybe I was wrong. Maybe I was right. I got this issue wrong. I got to rethink everything. You know, that's a great example. I did a story for Reason last year about how, you know, New York Times went from being a cheerleader for prohibition to, you know, saying it should be ended, and it's utterly absurd and always was. But, you know, in the process, not noting how, you know, wrong the New York Times itself had been. And it's sort of interesting how these changes happen. And it was not at all a straight line. You would think that was it, that they were introduced to this drug, marijuana. It was very scary. The Mexicans were using it. They were going crazy and killing people. And of course, we have to ban it. But there were actually these sort of spurts of skepticism in the Times early on, at least up until the 30s, where they actually ran articles saying, you know, everybody's talking about marijuana and how awful it is. There's really very little evidence of that. And here's the study that says it's really not so bad. And so we tend to think of people, you know, journalists from that era as being, you know, superstitious or something, and,
right,
and not believing in science. And but it wasn't true. There were, you know, there were some skeptical journalists back then, and there was an opportunity to look at the evidence. But in the end, they just went with what the cops were telling them, the prosecutors were saying, and the people they perceived as experts. And for decades, you didn't see any skepticism at all when it came to marijuana or to, you know, to other prohibited drugs. And you only started to see it emerging again, you know, in the 60s and in the 70s. But my God, what a slow process. And they ran an editorial where in passing, they're like, hey, you know, maybe we should legalize marijuana. In passing. And then literally like 40 years later, I'm like, yeah, that was a good idea.
Yeah. Where does the time go? Yeah, that's amazing.
But, you know, so it's interesting to see that. But like I said, it worries me that what you're seeing, I mean, you can look at it as a hopeful thing or a discouraging thing. It's like with gay marriage, right? So how did gay marriage become something most people could be okay with? And that's a sort of a more encouraging example because it's not something that most people are going to do.
Right. Yeah.
Right. But what happened is that they knew people who were gay, or they realized they knew people who were gay. They, you know, got to know gay couples, and it became more familiar and less scary, which is similar to the process with marijuana.
Well, we'll leave it for another podcast to ask whether or not a recreational marijuana dispensary owner in Colorado, if he's asked to cater a gay wedding, whether or not he should be forced to. We'll leave that for another time. But I want to thank you, Jacob, for talking about this. And I also, you know, I want to thank you for, you know, your long history in promoting, you know, a goddamn sensible policy that makes the world less shitty and more free. It's, you know, and hopefully, by the end of 2018, even more states will be on the right and, you know, on the right side of this issue. So thank you, Jacob.
I'm sure.
We've been talking with Jacob Solem. This is The Reason Podcast. I'm your host, Nick Gillespie. Thanks so much for listening. Please subscribe to us at iTunes and rate and review us while you're there.